this one, I can drag out.
Whispering profanities into the ears of unsuspecting victims, creeping into female changing rooms, leaving the house wearing nothing. Ian, thanks for taking time out from your usual routine to join us for The Rest Is Noise, a podcast on a mission to assign songs to every concept, person, people, place, or thing. This week, my guests will be duking it out to decide the perfect song to embody a rather elusive topic, The Invisible Man. They are the ever-transparent, part-time DJ and full-time joggo, Ian Wilkinson.
Hello.
Music, travel and lifestyle journalist, Richie McKeegan.
Hi.
Journalist and indie filmmaker, Hazel Sheffield.
Hello.
And, in our guest slot, our very own Invisible Man, ghostwriter Greg Rose.
Hi.
So, The Invisible Man was first conceived by H.G. Wells 120 years ago this year. It was first adapted for screen in 1933 with Claude Rains, who died half a century ago this year, in the title role. And, in case you're thinking our topic this week is somewhat out of date, well, Universal Studios would disagree. They're rebooting The Invisible Man early next year, with it starring Johnny Depp. So, I have to start with the obvious question, don't I? Why has Johnny Depp basically given up on his career?
I'm surprised anyone's employing him.
I mean, he is invisible, though. That's the plus side. We don't have to look at his flabby face.
He's got three franchises on the go at the moment now. The Alice in Wonderland franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean.
And he's opening a spa.
Oh, right. There we are. Of course, you can interpret... Well, my guests will be expected to interpret The Invisible Man any way they like. But, Greg, you are an Invisible Man of sorts in that you're a ghostwriter.
Yeah, it feels weird for you to say that. I'm a very recent ghostwriter, so I've not got used to being described in that way. Yeah, it's odd because you are essentially having to embody the voice of somebody else. And then after a while, that becomes your own, and then it becomes more difficult to get writing in your own voice than in somebody else's.
So did you have to listen to... Are we allowed to speak about the person that you ghostwrote for, and who was that?
I worked for Virgin, so I collaborated with Richard Branson on his autobiography.
And so did you have to spend a lot of time with him to ascertain what his voice was?
Yeah, but I do that on a daily basis anyway, so I kind of had a good grounding to get to that point. But then actually working on going from like daily blogging and social media to a long form book is quite a different tone of voice.
And you said you started to, now that's become your voice anyway, somehow, in writing or what, in your personality at all?
Oh, Jesus, no. In writing, then if I'm writing something for myself, then I have to be conscious of making that shift.
You have to check yourself.
Exactly.
Does a great Branson impression.
At parties.
Only when written down, though.
Yeah. At parties. Crap party. Right, well, we'll look forward to hearing your choice later on, but we're going to start with you, Richie. Richie, what have you chosen?
I've chosen The Downtown Lights by the Blue Nile. Was The Downtown Lights by the Blue Nile off a record called Hats from 1989. It's got a hat on the cover of it. The Invisible Man wore a hat. So that's me done.
I'm wondering that you maybe have gone down two possible routes with this. One is that the band themselves, particularly elusive, and then maybe your second layer, something to do with the lyrics?
Yeah, yeah. So in a very simple way, the Downtown Lights, this song, as you probably got from the mood and the lyrics, has that very rain-swept Edward Hopper painting, lonely wandering around noirish streets, which is very much a thing that the Blue Nile specialised in, and this was the pinnacle of that. I don't know if you know which streets he's referring to, though.
Scottish, aren't they?
They are, yes.
The streets of Glasgow.
They are, the streets of Glasgow, which kind of adds a layer to it, I think, when you wear it. It's got this sort of glamorous tinge to it musically, but it's actually the sort of gritty, grey streets of Glasgow.
I would never have guessed
that. Yeah. Almost certainly chucking it down.
Yes, yeah. Just that. All the time.
The blur of the rain against neon and street lights. Yeah, you sort of do get a sense of that.
What I found really interesting, so I was trying to look for essentially sort of the invisible men in music, you know, either behind the scenes players or people we don't know very much about, or, you know, the sort of unsung heroes. And I was thinking along the lines of Burial, and I thought about picking an obscure pop songwriter, but I just kept coming back to this because I thought it just embodied the whole thing particularly well. And there was a great story that a piece in the Scottish Herald explained about the band. They had no notion that playing in a band was glamorous or for any sort of congratulation. And they aimed, according to this Herald article, to become the antithesis, a band as modest and as covert as possible.
It's the invisible man. Mm-hmm.
And they have been. They have been incredibly quiet. They've been incredibly elusive. And what popped this back into my mind for this is that Paul Buchanan popped up on the new Jessie Ware record, which came out a couple of weeks ago, on a chat called Last of the True Believers, which is great, actually. There's something where her and his Venn diagram overlap, that sort of sultry.
What they do really well is they're taking the typical 80s soundscape, the slightly tinny drums and the synths that were introduced in that era, but they make them really warm. It sounds so warm and lovely, even though it's about Glasgow. And obviously Jessie Ware has a little bit of that in her too, so I can understand why they work together. Didn't they also go on to work with Peter Gabriel?
Peter Gabriel was a big fan of theirs. As artists, they got quite a gang of fans. So Peter Gabriel was an acclaimed one. Annie Lennox recorded one of the Blue Nile songs. Isaac Hayes was a fan. Robbie Robertson was a fan. So they certainly picked up a few big names and collaborators along the way. But there was a nice quote from Paul Buchanan who said, "For us, it was always about that Walt Whitman thing of standing up for the stupid and the crazy, about the fat kid that nobody noticed." And so there are these kind of outsider, lonely anthems and kind of washed in that. It's very, very produced. They've openly sort of stated that the studio was, you know, their tool. They took years to make records. Mm. They only really made three, and then Paul Buchanan did a solo record.
What are we thinking, though? The rest of you? Invisible Man?
They're more or less invisible to me. I think the only time I've come across them is in a sort of 5 or 6 year cycle when they're on Jules Holland with something else to promote.
I was thinking of that, and not knowing that they were from Glasgow until then. It's then listening to it makes me thinking about the Scarlett Johansson, Under the Skin.
Yeah.
Where she's kind of invisible driving around in a van and not being a movie star. Being just a run-of-the-mill random person who turns out to be an alien. Sorry, anyone who hasn't seen Under the Skin. driving around in that. And I feel like that could have been the better soundtrack. It was Mikachu did the soundtrack, and it was all those kind of screeching. And yeah.
Somebody should do a recut of the Blue Nile and that film. Yeah. I think also the archetypal image of the Invisible Man in terms of the character has that very film noir-y look of like a hat and the sunglasses and the trench coat with the collar up and the, you know, the bandaged face. Mm. So there is that kind of look, that classic look of that filmic look of walking down a rainy street with the neon on your own and you're alone with your thoughts, which ties in. And then when you look at the lyrics, "Sometimes I walk away when all I really want to do is love and hold you right." sort of bits.
Yeah, the word empty, empty streets, empty streets, empty trains, empty bars, full of invisible people.
I think if you're going to tie it back to the original book and the film, the feeling and the mood of it is nowhere near unhinged enough. It's almost too polished for H.G. Wells's Invisible Man, who was a psychopath and he used that magic ability for
evil,
for nefarious purposes.
Well, you say magic, but it was very rooted in science. H.G. Wells went to great lengths to try and make this sound scientifically feasible. For example, when he first disappears, the thing he notices is that his eyelids are see-through. So he has to sleep with his eyes covered, which I thought was really clever.
Yeah. Mm.
It's the bandages, yeah.
Another cool thing that H.G. Wells considers was that because he couldn't see his feet, it made walking downstairs really difficult.
Mm.
So he fell down the stairs the first time he was invisible. Well, that looks great.
I'd always have considered invisibility being everything's the same except no one can see you.
Mm.
So if I went like that, I could still see it. But it was his imagining of it that
you can't see yourself.
Nothing. There's nothing. Just
that would
just,
be a horrible thing. That, isn't
then
it
gets weird. Yeah. I'd always just assumed, of course, you just live your life like normal, but no one can see you.
Oh, I see. Right.
But then it's harder to relate if you're writing that because it needs to be based on the science. I was reading a thing this week that was talking about Disney's genius of how he's the first person to do cartoons that were basically grounded in physics. So the way that when they fall down, they grimace and they fall in the way that somebody would in real life. And then that makes us be able to relate and feel like it's okay that there's a talking mouse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that would make sense if you did that with an invisible mouse.
That was Walt Disney's big aim, wasn't it? To make us cry and laugh in the same film. And he did that by filming real live action actors performing the things that Snow White and the dwarves actually did.
And he made his animators go and do like life drawing. And to get
to
grounding.
And he was a Nazi.
And he was a Nazi.
Mm. the last thing that H.G. Wells picked up on, which was fascinating, I've always considered this, I think, as a child wondering about it, what about when he eats food? And this is completely detailed in the novel many, many times. He gets around it by saying that when he eats food, it is there. He has to hide behind a rock after he's eaten because the food is going down his gullet. But he just uses very clever words to sidestep what happens to the food later on, in that it has to be assimilated into the body. So it doesn't talk about what happens when it comes out the other end.
Yeah, see, that I find weird. If you're going to see food going down, then surely you would see
poo
and pee and everything else just in there at all times. You're like, you're not invisible, mate. You've got a half a bladder. I can see it. So it doesn't matter much of that.
Imagine if you just saw half a bladder coming towards you. That would be terrifying.
But what's interesting too is I went and read a lot about the band, and they've got a particularly cult fan base in Scotland, I think, and so many people don't, you know, he's the kind of guy who could walk through a bar and nobody would turn their head, but there's been this slowly kind of growing reappreciation of their back catalogue in, you know, quite revered terms. But there was a guy, an author called Alan Brown, who wrote a book about them called Nihilism, which is a good title, well played. Who describes the band as a riddle wrapped in enigma, wrapped in a raincoat.
Ooh.
Which I thought was pretty apt for the Invisible Man.
Wow, lots of imagery here from all corners. Good work, Rich. We're going to move on and hear our next choice. It's from you, Hazel. What have you got for us?
I have the story of OJ by Jay-Z. Light nigga, dark nigga, faux nigga, real nigga, rich nigga, poor nigga, house nigga, feel nigga, still nigga, still nigga. OJ like, I'm not black, I'm OJ. Okay, house nigga, don't fuck with me, I'm a feel nigga, or shine cutlery. Go play the quarters where the butlers be. I'ma play the corners where the hustlers be. I told them, please don't die over the neighborhood. So that was the story of OJ, and it was on Jay-Z's comeback album, 444, which came out a bit earlier this year. We just watched the video here, actually. The song itself, and the video especially, examines the history of racial stereotyping in the US, and by proxy, the history of the US itself. And I think the video is particularly amazing. It was directed by Jay-Z with a guy called Mark Romanek. and it employs a host of racially charged caricatures and different references. It looks like a Looney Tunes film, but with blackface and minstrelsy to kind of break a silence on topics of slavery, therapy and money.
Yeah, I have an inkling as to why you may have chosen this. My first thought was story of OJ. There's a reference and a visual of OJ Simpson in the video, which is fantastic. And I wondered if you were going down the route of the Invisible Man, that OJ, that we didn't know about OJ. He was this outwardly very successful sportsman and celebrity. We didn't, there was an Invisible Man within that, this horrible, brutal murderer.
Also because the Invisible Man had to wear gloves in order to be seen, and OJ is famously, the gloves didn't fit him.
Wow, okay. Is that going to...
No.
Go against you.
No, I guess OJ has something to do with it, but for me, the one of the most amazing lines in that song actually is when Jay-Z sings, "I'm just OJ," and then he just gives this massive pause and goes, "Okay."
Yeah.
And it's like no one cares that he's OJ, because he is still a black man in America, which comes with it certain connotations that he can never escape. The Invisible Man, for me, I never actually read or saw the H.G. Wells book or film, but I did at a very impressionable age read the Ralph Ellison novel, which was also called The Invisible Man.
I'm very glad that you're bringing it up.
And it was published in 1952, which is obviously a very different time for civil rights in America, and it was about an unnamed African-American man who considered himself socially invisible. You never learn the name of the narrator in this piece, but it's all in the first person. He says, "I am an invisible man. I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe. I'm not one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fibre and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me." And then the novel goes on from this amazing starting point. Through these altercations, he gets into a street fight, but the aggressor never even acknowledges him, even when he holds a knife to his throat. He goes back to when he was young and he wins a scholarship to an all-black college, but he's humiliated in front of the white trustees and then later expelled. He works at a white paint shop, but loses his job. He joins the Brotherhood and then becomes disillusioned with the black community. And then eventually at the end, he's mistaken for someone else, a musician and a lover. And this character has assimilated into white society at the cost of his own identity. And then the black community that he was formerly a part of come after him and try and lynch him for being a traitor. So like OJ, it doesn't matter what he does, he cannot escape the root part of his identity, which makes him invisible in society.
Well, with OJ, it was interesting, wasn't it? Did anyone see the documentary series recently about it? Phenomenal piece of documentary making. And it almost seemed that OJ successfully removed himself from being a part of the black community, and in fact shunned many members of the black community, until suddenly he needed them. And that was what was so dark about watching those events unfold, that after everything, after he'd got away with it, and after the white community realised this guy is probably a murderer, he sort of came crawling back to the people who were pillars of the black community, and some of them shunned him, and some of them took him in as a sort of figure of an icon or an idol. It's a very bizarre development with him. Jay-Z's cutting through all of that, because the whole theme of that documentary was that OJ tries to shed his blackness, and Jay-Z just says, okay. Yeah, it's a really powerful line. In fact, the whole video is very, very powerful.
He wasn't black man for a while until he committed a crime, I think. And then
Yeah, and that's where there are echoes of the Ralph Ellison book, which is beautifully 65 years old this year.
Of course.
Which is nice and neat.
It's like you planned it.
I know, well, yeah, I wouldn't like to say I did. But...
Where does Jay-Z's real estate advice in the song link into the theme of the Invisible Man? He talks about how his artwork's accrued value, how he should have bought property in certain parts of New York.
I could have bought a place in Dumbo before it was Dumbo for like $2 million. That same building today is worth $25 million. Guess how I'm feeling? Dumbo.
What is that, the trait of the Invisible Man? Financial.
I think he is saying to young. I take from that he is saying to his younger So people who are younger than him in hip hop, look after your money, be sensible, don't splurge.
Rock and roll advice.
It's not very rock and roll, but it's saying, you know, you are on the fringes of the society, you're always vulnerable. Look after your investments, essentially.
And no one will have a better apartment than me.
Well, this is his confessional album, isn't it? It's where he's supposed to now be giving the true voice of Jay-Z after all the big talk in previous albums. He admits to adultery against his wife, Beyonce. He reveals that his mum actually is a lesbian and that he's okay with that. And well, yeah, exactly, yeah. So... yeah, it wouldn't immediately have linked back to the Ralph Ellison novel. I like the way you've done that. For me, the video, Pete, I do urge everyone to watch it. It's a great piece of work. Does anyone know the where the sample's from?
It's a Nina Simone song, right?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's, yeah.
What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
It's four women.
Yeah.
Who produced the Jay-Z song, the Nina Simone song? Does anyone know?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds very like Jay Diller, I think.
It has got a very wobbly.
Yeah. Sort of pitch shifted vocals.
I was going to say it can't be him because he's dead, but it hasn't stopped him producing several dozens of work since he died.
He released his first vocal album last year, didn't he? So he's first album he's rapped on. He's been dead 10 years. Quite impressive.
And OJ himself is no longer invisible, so to speak. He's out of prison as of this year, right?
I imagine he's keeping a fairly low profile.
Yeah. Yeah, Jay-Z certainly isn't invisible, that's for sure. They're saying now that he's going to be the first hip-hop artist to make $1 billion. It was touted that Dre would do it, but actually, no. It's probably going to be Jay-Z.
Because he bought all those properties in Dumbo.
Yeah,
No, he didn't, though, did he?
He didn't, though.
He didn't buy them, but he's bought some art.
I thought he did have a really sweet apartment in Dumbo, the one that overlooks the carousel and the bridge.
But if he'd have bought it 10 years ago, it would have been half the price.
Oh, yeah. Should have done it.
Regrets.
Very wise choice, Hazel, there, linking it back to the other Invisible Man. On to track number 3. For this episode. Ian, what have you gone for?
I've gone for Smog and Teenage Spaceship.
A teenage spaceship. A teenage spaceship. And I swore I'd never lay like a log, bark like a dog. I was a teenage.
That was Smog and Teenage Spaceship from Smog's 1999 album Knock Knock, which was his second collaboration with producer Jim O'Rourke. Smog is the pseudonym of Bill Callahan, which is the name he records under now. He started in the early 90s making very noisy, mainly instrumental music, and then literally found his voice and started singing. Been called variously the lo-fi Leonard Cohen and the one-man Joy Division, which I think are both references which are pretty much on the money as far as accusations of miserialism go. But where does that link into The Invisible Man?
Yeah, I mean, for many years, you read any review of a Smog or a Bill Callahan album and it talks about how the man himself is elusive and invisible behind the characters and the feeling, the atmosphere that he creates. Is it that your angle?
Yeah, it's definitely about his lyrics and the person he paints as maybe compared to who he is in real life.
It felt like he, certainly with his last record, kind of stepped out of that invisibility a bit and kind of wore his heart on his sleeve a bit more and was a little bit more open about being happy and where he is in life, and
that never normally makes for very good material, does it? When artists reach that point of having children and having a nice big house and everything's rosy, the albums usually get pretty crap. But
I'd agree with Rich that it probably is his most contented sounding album, the last one, Dream River, and actually I think one of his best is Bill Callahan. But it is about lots of his lyrics paint him as an outsider and someone who's very much wants to stay on the edge of things. And there's lots of references throughout his career and throughout his lyrics of watching things go on and almost being invisible. So even on the last album, where he was very much part of it, there's still a song called Small Plane, which is about him being high above everything and witnessing things.
Yeah. I really am a lucky man flying this small plane.
A couple on the album previous to this, Red Apple Falls, which are about him being outside of society. So ex-con is there's a line about him being most happy when he's alone in his room and doesn't trust himself going out into society because of the bad things he might do. But for me, I think this is where he goes the furthest into being truly invisible, where he talks about the metaphor of being a teenage spaceship and being so far removed from everyone else that he's literally sewn to the sky like the stars.
So your invisible man then is metaphorical.
Don't you think there's a kind of arrogance about that? I associate Bill Callahan with a kind of singularity that could be interpreted as arrogance, certainly.
I think he's a very complex character, and I think that comes across in a lot of his lyrics.
Maybe he thinks that he's too good to associate with everyone else.
I think he doesn't think he's good enough.
Mm. What makes you say that?
There's a lot in this album and the album previous to it where there's lyrics where he seems to cast himself very much as a societal outsider. There's songs on this album about prisoners, about running away from things and moving to the country and starting again. It sounds like he's not that he's aloof necessarily, but he's just outside of everything that's going on. And that definitely does soften a lot as he goes on through his career and certainly becomes more comfortable with who he is, I think.
In a Pitchfork interview from 2013, the interviewer said that he seems to believe that his personality and the details of his life are inessential to the enjoyment of his music.
The sort of bits of spotlight that did shine on him often came from who he was dating.
Yeah, notably Cat Power and Joni Newsom, which kind of links in with the paradox, I think, of him, someone who cast himself in his songs around this time as being an outsider on the edge and being this invisible man, when actually, rumour has it, to get gossip worthy, he was quite a controlling, overbearing partner to both those people, and which they've alluded to in interviews and alluded to in songs.
In Go Long by Joni Newsom, she sings, "You don't even own your own violence." And then she talks more generally about men. That song is about men, but it's been widely regarded that it's about him specifically and her relationship with him. "With the loneliness of you mighty men, with your jaws and fists and guitars and pens, who made you this way? Who made you this way?"
With the loneliness of you mighty men, with your jaws and fists and guitars and pens and your sugar lips.
That flies in the face of you suggesting that maybe he's not confident enough about his music and that perhaps, like what Hazel was saying, he is a little bit aloof and he is a little bit full of himself.
Well, I was thinking about that quote of the details of his life are inessential to the enjoyment of music. Is that to his enjoyment of the music or to ours? Hmm. Is he preferring that we don't know these details in order for us to enjoy it more?
Around the same time of the interview, it might even be the same one, but he talked a lot about how he writes an album in character. And every album is a different character, and once he's finished that album, he moves on to someone else. But all those characters are facets of his life at various points, and actually the character that he writes the album in might not be him personally at that point in time, but it's someone he was in the past, or potentially could be in the future.
He's a method musician, is he?
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to say about Joni Newsom, Cat Power, most brilliant bit of revenge of musical relationships is Cat Power when she did a covers album. So either the covers album, I can't really work out which song it is because she recorded two of Smog songs, Bathysphere and Red Apples. And one of them she purposely recorded and ruined and did it really badly because it was one of his favourite songs of his own. That's great, isn't
that
it?
That is great. Yeah.
Do you mean you can't work out which one's the bad one?
Neither of them are great versions.
Oh no! Oh no!
Maybe that was the whole point.
Well, if we're to follow Hazel's line of argument, then that perhaps he is, and maybe Joanna Newsom, what she's saying about him, that he's slightly egomaniacal, then that links back to the Invisible Man very well, and it actually falls to your favour.
Well, yeah, that's the other link, that the Invisible Man is maybe invisible, but he does very, very bad things.
He does very bad things. He stole money for the research to become invisible from his father, leading his father to shoot himself. He didn't pay for his father's funeral. This is in the H.G. Wells novel. He had a pauper's funeral and he was the only man there. He murdered, he stole, he bullied. He's a vicious human being in the novel, but perfectly played by Johnny Depp in the movie, we presume. Good casting. What's everyone else thinking then for The Invisible Man? Teenage spaceship. It's not a track title that immediately screams Invisible Man.
Well, they're two things in of themselves that suggest invisibility. There's that very kind of classic teenage, oh, no one understands me, no one sees who I am, blah, blah, blah. And obviously spaceships, as far as we know, don't exist. So on just a very surface level, it's a bit of a weak metaphor for feeling invisible to say, it's like, oh, two things that are invisible but together. But I kind of respect his songwriting a bit too much to suggest it's that would have been probably a deliberate decision.
His take on the song is that he wrote it while he was living in his parents' basement, and he had very strange sleeping patterns and used to just walk around the streets. I think it's in Virginia, I might be wrong there, but would just get up in the middle of the night and walk around when there's no one around. And the idea of being a spaceship flying around at night was kind of what he felt like an alien, and that's where that came from. Don't know, maybe he was a teenager at the time. Unconfirmed. Not sure.
Just go out in the day, mate. There's loads of people around.
That brings us to our final track of this evening. And it's you, Greg. What have you chosen?
I've chosen The Beatles with The Fool on the Hill.
Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud. But nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make. And he never seems to notice what the fool on the hill sees, the sun going down and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
I feel like I kind of default by turning up as a guest and choosing The Beatles. That's just, it's like beyond obvious.
Desert Island Discs.
Yeah. But anyway, it's what came to mind. So that was the Fool on the Hill, which was released by The Beatles in 1967. It's Lennon-McCartney. It's clearly written by Paul McCartney, and it appeared on the Magical Mystery Tour record. Paul himself said that it was inspired by Maharishi, the giggling guru, but there are lots of other interpretations of the song.
Yeah, wasn't there a guy who walked along next to him and his biographer on Primrose Hill, and then as they were talking about God, and then he walked away again and they thought he was God? Is that what it was?
That's right. Well, there is a probably apocryphal tale of Paul walking with his biographer and his dog Martha on Primrose Hill, and apparently they were discussing the existence or otherwise of God when a mysterious stranger appeared on the vista, and they looked up and then they looked at each other and looked back and he had vanished. And then from that, this provoked Paul to write this song and the lyrical content of it. But actually, that meeting took place several months after the song had been written.
Oh,
so
no.
It's just not true. But I kind of like that. I like that people want it to be.
Mm. Paul was dead at that point anyway, though, wasn't he?
So this is 1968.
Could be feasible.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It could have been Paul on the hill looking at fake Paul.
Paul on the hill.
Wagging his finger. That could have been it.
So what are we thinking here then? Lots of interesting lyrics that you could take your cues from in terms of invisibility. Well on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud, but nobody ever hears him
or the sound he appears to make. That doesn't scream to me an invisible man, that's starting to scream to me a little bit God.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's certainly one way that you could take it. And that, yeah, there is that omnipresence within the thousand faces, and all seeing, all knowing, and appears foolish, but actually is watching over us all and seeing everything we're doing, leading us in the right way. But I think there's a lot more going on than that. And I like Paul's suggestion around the Maharishi, but yeah, I also just like the idea that, you know, the invisible man being omnipresent, and it's Paul McCartney who is basically everywhere with his with his V sign up singing Hey Jude. So I like just bringing Paul in for the invisible man, because if you are everywhere, then maybe you're nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was nowhere man as well.
Exactly. But that was actually
Lakers.
That was actually a I thought about that, but that's obviously a John song. And I like that Paul wrote this kind of as a retort to it along very similar themes. And then if you listen to the two, one is so clearly John singing about John, and then this song just has a lot more of a broad view going on, and it kind of captures their characters quite well, I think. And depending on which one you prefer, is probably on which one of those songs you prefer.
Well, John in his typically condescending way of talking about Paul said about this song, "Now that's Paul, another good lyric, shows he's capable of writing complete songs."
Exactly, and it is kind of understated. I like this song is kind of it's worthy of John's mockery, and it's kind of hidden in the Beatles' own catalogue. Like, and you know, a lot of people would just pass over this song, and I like that it's kind of hidden, and it's I think that kind of makes it more suitable. And then musically as well, then if you did, like the way that the song goes, it kind of veers from minor key to major key and back to minor key, and it kind of floats in and out in the way that I would if I was invisible. That's how I'd picture things being, because you wouldn't want to be invisible the whole time, you'd want to dip in and out.
The description that John often gave of Paul's music, he wasn't so favourable, as I've said in the last quotation. He also referred to a lot of Paul's songs as Paul's granny shit. And this seems
fits squarely in the granny shit. Where, yeah, it does.
You've got recorders in there. You've got a very sort of...
You've got maracas. I bet Paul's like, that's young and cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds like a Liam Gallagher quote, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It actually, I'll go for the other grandparent. It also, the reason I chose it was because it makes me think about my granddad, and it's his favourite Beatles song. And then there's also this character who was the first person who came to mind when I thought about The Invisible Man, who's this guy who I knew when I was younger playing football. And we would have this guy who would just always be there in the background, and he would genuinely stand on a hill. And a lot of people thought that he was foolish and being very blatant in the description. But he was our education liaison officer. So it was his job to basically make sure that the footballers kind of went to school once a month and, signed a register. But he was actually really interesting, and he was really smart and kind. But most people thought that he was a bit of an idiot because they were 16-year-old footballers and he was like a 60-year-old man with a beard, you know, who was interested in liaising about education. And then one day I was playing the Beatles on my Discman, and he asked me what I was listening to, and I told him. And the next day he turned up, and he'd been clearing out his dad's house, and he brought me around every single Beatles album LP that was released. I've got a complete Beatles record collection.
Ooh,
thanks to his dad, who I never met. But he like wrote a note and was like, "Hope you get enjoyment out of these." So he's kind of my invisible hero.
Wow.
Wow.
Mm.
What
that's great.
What a shame H.G. Wells' Invisible Man wasn't a hero. He was a villain.
That's true. That is true.
Damn it.
But I never met...
He's more of a Stones fan.
But I never met the guy's dad. He could have been
awful. He could have been dreadful.
He could have been terrible.
He could have been the Invisible Man. H.G. Yeah. Wells is invisible.
There you go, yeah. Or H.G. Wells himself.
He was very old.
Quite visible.
Well, lots of layers there that we weren't possibly expecting. I think this song maybe even sounds better as performed by Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still.
Which is a phenomenal cover. Went top 10 in 1968. Did Fall on the Hill didn't chart that well, did it? For Imagine no. Mystery Tour?
No, not at all. And I think that came out, the next year, the Sergio Mendes came out and was a hit, and then it's been like a minor hit a few times, but I don't really know why. It doesn't sound like a hit. It doesn't feel like it should be. It's been covered by Aretha Franklin, Shirley Bassey, Sarah Vaughan, but it's the kind of song that you'd put two-thirds through a set when people probably feeling like they need to go to the bar, and then when they do, they'll be really disappointed that they missed it.
well argued, Greg. That was fascinating. It's now time for us all to decide which of those four tracks best embodies the bodiless Invisible Man.
Is he bodiless? Don't want to yeah. pick holes in your outro, Martin. But,
On we go to the vote, then. So customarily, we start with the person who started, and that is you, Rich.
Well, I'm going to be very visible with my emotions and say it's been very hard. It was a good week of good arguments and good songs all round. But for quite a deep and quite current discussion of invisibility and a place in society, I'm going to have to go with Hazel's choice of Jay-Z.
Hazel.
I'm going for Greg. Not just because you're new, it's not a sympathy vote. I really liked the descriptions of John Lennon's descriptions of Paul McCartney's songs as granny music. And I also had never really thought about that song before, so it was invisible to me until tonight.
Ian.
I also like Greg's story, particularly just a man humping a box of Beatles vinyls up a hill to some 16-year-olds playing football. But I'm going to also choose Hazel's choice of Jay-Z because it's just a great song, isn't it?
And argument, though.
And argument as well.
Greg.
I'm going to go for Richie's because, yeah, as an artist, that I'm thinking about the invisibility of not of gaps in my awareness, and I'd not heard of them, I'd not heard of the song, and then listening to it is going to make me want to listen to them more, and I really like the imagery in it. I think it fit with, if I had a soundtrack to the book in my head, it would sound like that probably.
One vote for Richie, one vote for Greg, but the song that best embodies the Invisible Man is The Story of OJ by Jay-Z. Well done, Hazel. You can hear it and other Invisible Man themed music on the Spotify playlist you'll find at our website, therestisnoise.org. Next week's topic,
octopuses.
Got a song to soundtrack supposedly the world's most intelligent invertebrate, even though when under stress they apparently eat their own arms? Let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or on our website. Right, one word from our winner.